Thank you for downloading this podcast of Claire Robinson discussing pantomime and Captain Bainbridge, recorded at the British Society of Sports History North West Workshop in November 2012.
In the February of 1889, Captain Richard Boosfield Bainbridge, lessee of the Manchester Theatre Royal, was declared bankrupt, owing a total of £32,025, 18 shillings and a penny. Using the Bainbridge story as a case study, my paper today considers the regional experience of pantomime and the crucial role it played in the survival or otherwise of provincial theatres in the 1880s. Reporting on the first meeting of Bainbridge's creditors on the 26th of March, the Standard in London had summarised that the debtor alleged bad business, the failure of the last pantomime, and the competition of new theatres in outlying towns as the cause of his failure. Bankruptcy was not unknown in the Manchester theatres. Charles Bernard had been declared bankrupt at the Prince's Theatre in 1882. And Edward Garcia of the Comedy Theatre would find himself in a similar position, having overstretched his commitments in 1890. What was remarkable about Captain Bainbridge in Manchester was the scale of his debts. Here I will trace the history of Bainbridge's bankruptcy and consider his claims about the role played by pantomime in his downfall, along with the available evidence, to establish the importance of pantomime in late Victorian theatre and to the other genres that can be seen to have supported. By the 1880s, provincial theatres were functioning largely as receiving houses presenting tours of London productions. And here we have a relatively recent photo of the Theatre Royal in Manchester, which is Bainbridge's theatre. The pantomime was usually the only in-house production of the theatrical year. Its importance then was not only to compete with its local rivals to produce the most commercially successful pantomime in the city, but also to establish an individual identity for each theatre. At the height of its popularity in the mid and late Victorian period, it was not unusual for the largest theatres to employ up to 500 people to appear in the extravagant production of their annual pantomime, as can be seen in this illustration from the Theatre Royal's 1883-84 pantomime, Babes in the Wood. The Theatre Royal had one of the largest stages outside of London, which was capable of accommodating productions that had transferred from Drury Lane. Manchester is not the ideal city to choose for an investigation into Victorian theatre finance, as very little has survived in the way of accounts for the various theatres. All the figures I quote here today are taken from newspaper reports, but serve well enough, I believe, to create a picture that is reasonably accurate if thinking in broad brushstrokes. The report of the official receiver in the Bainbridge case commented that it would appear that the bankrupt has kept no books of account. The Manchester Times, in its report on the case, noted that from 1883 up to the present, Mr. S.R. Platt had a share in the profits under the Partnership Law Amendment Act. Now, Samuel Platt, some of you might be familiar with, was part of the engineering firm Mather and Platt, and at this time he was the chair of the Manchester Ship Canal Company. It was recorded that some accounts were reported to have been filed with a local solicitor for the benefit of Samuel Platt, and a cash book and some books of invoices were retrieved from the Theatre Royal. No accounts for the Theatre Royal appear to have survived, and from the evidence provided, it would seem no complete accounts ever existed. It is, however, possible, using the detailed newspaper reports, to trace the main features of Captain Bainbridge's financial history, from his arrival at the Theatre Royal in 1880 to the state of affairs at the time of his bankruptcy. Now, this picture, which is the detail taken out of that larger picture, is the only image that I have managed to find of Captain Bainbridge, because I have got photographs of most of the other people that I look at my research. Bainbridge was born in Manchester in 1846 into a middle-class family with American connections. He rose to the rank of captain in the American army and then returned to England where, using £3,000 that he had borrowed from his aunt, he became a partner in the Theatre Royal in August 1880, claiming previous experience in theatre management at Niblo's Garden Theatre in New York. This was an off-Broadway theatre and was quite well known at the time. This claim suggests that his experience was limited when contrasted with the evidence he gave at his public examination in his bankruptcy hearing, in which it was reported that, in answer to the official receiver, Mr. C.J. Dibb, the debtor stated that he was never engaged in any business prior to his embarking in theatrical speculations. Certainly the detail of his early years at the Theatre Royal suggests a naivety matched only by his ambition. He very soon became the sole lessee on the retirement of his partner John Duffield in 1881, and rather than focusing on consolidating his business at the Theatre Royal, he also took on a 21-year lease at the Royal Court Theatre in Liverpool. In September 1881, Bainbridge used his stake in the two theatres as his capital investment to become a partnership in a short-lived syndicate operating these two theatres and the Prince's Theatre in Manchester. The Manchester Times reported that the syndicate was dissolved early in 1883 and his share of the losses was about £2,000. Bainbridge later claimed, however, that when the syndicate terminated, he was quite solvent. At around the time the syndicate came to the end, Bainbridge received an inheritance of £1,000 following the death of the former MP for Bath, Colonel Nathaniel Boosfield, and that would have relieved much of the loss of his loss from the syndicate. Later in 1883, Bainbridge was forced to sell the lease of the Royal Court to his friend Carl Rosa. In his bankruptcy hearing, he admitted that on that theatre he lost £10,000. The reason being that the Liverpool public did not appreciate the entertainment he provided for them and did not extend to it the patronage required to support the heavy expenses to which he was poor. Bainbridge went on to make further unsuccessful investments in a provincial tour of the Bugger Prince that cost him a further £3,700 and in his partnership in a switchback railway at the Manchester Golden Jubilee exhibition in 1887, where an acrimonious dispute with his partner in that venture led to court costs that swallowed all the profits. So we've totted up there to him being £17,200 in debt, and then he lost a further £18,000 at the Theatre Royal. Now, £8,000 of that is what he actually lost on the pantomime, which pushed him over the edge. But the losses, where he owed money, again, the £7,000 we've already seen from Samuel Platt, and Aunt Mary, who started off lending him the original £3,000, and his sister's inheritance from Captain Boosfield, all added up to quite a lot of money. And strangely, they did carry on all living in the same house. The history of Bainbridge's unsuccessful business career, revealed during his bankruptcy hearing, suggests that he was both naive and overambitious. But studying the evidence provided about his finances, one is struck by the loss of the £10,000 at the Royal Court Theatre in Liverpool, which Bainbridge carried from 1883 until his bankruptcy. Seems likely without this burden on his finances, he would have hovered around a break-even point throughout most of those 5 years, which allowed him to continue even after he experienced the comparative failure of the 1888 pantomime The 40 Thieves. The Manchester Guardian observed the financial importance of pantomime to the theatres on Christmas Eve of 1888, writing, "It is perhaps a strange taste that fills the theatres for those 2 months and leaves them half empty for the greater part of the other 10. But it exists. We cannot honestly say that it has been created by the managers, and the managers have to meet it." During the bankruptcy hearing, Captain Bainbridge would inform the court that outside of the pantomime season, while the expenses of the theatre remained the same, the travelling companies took such large sums, in some cases as much as 77.5% of the gross receipts, that although these engagements were popular, there was nothing at the end of them left for the local manager. As an in-house production, the pantomime allowed the theatres, while responsible for the production costs, to retain all the income, making it desirable for the theatre managers to prolong the run of a successful pantomime. Bainbridge did not refer to Drury Lane pantomimes in his advertising, but there is evidence that he was not only influenced by them for his own productions, and that he had business relations with Augustus Harris that included hiring sets and costumes from the Drury Lane for Manchester. In The Politics of the Pantomime, Jill Sullivan has discussed this with reference to evidence of a dispute between the two managers. In February 1887, Harris had sued Bainbridge for what he believed to be money owing to him from his contract to supply sets and costumes for Bluebeard. This was settled out of court, and it was confirmed in the Manchester Times that the misunderstanding between Mr. Harris of Drury Lane and Captain Bainbridge of Manchester Theatre Royal has been amicably settled. The pantomime here serves to illustrate the cracks appearing in Bainbridge's finances 2 years before he was declared bankrupt. At the beginning of the 1888 pantomime season, Bainbridge anticipated a large profit from the 40 Thieves. This was not an unreasonable expectation, as in every previous year, Captain Bainbridge's annual at the Theatre Royal had been a success. In an article entitled Preparing the Pantomime, published at Christmas 1888, the Manchester Guardian advised that if a caterer is not in touch with the people for whom he provides and does not know their palate to a nicety, he is apt to make sad mistakes by endeavouring to foist upon them unpalatable commodities which they reject, to the consequent shrinking of his funds. Ironically, this was published exactly at the time when Captain Bainbridge was making this mistake. The Manchester Times sympathised with the particular pressures placed on the manager of the Patent House in its review of the 40 Thieves. When Captain Bainbridge produces a new pantomime at the Theatre Royal, he has more than ordinary responsibilities. He must feel the stress of the pantomime traditions of the house, remarked the reviewer, continuing to note that the capacity and size of the stage at the city's largest theatre, a successful pantomime at the Theatre Royal, and such is the 40 Thieves, must be rich in spectacle and must be built upon a large scale. That which suits the little vaudeville would never do for the big Drury Lane. His method for producing the best pantomime was to invest heavily in creating the most spectacular extravaganza of sets and costumes of high Victorian pantomime, in the style his friend Augustus Harris employed at Drury Lane. This had worked previously for him, but this year a slight misjudgment of a shift in public taste would see his now old-fashioned pantomime lose ground in the competition with the Prince's Theatre and the Comedy Theatre. Both these theatres produced exceptionally popular pantomimes in the 1888 to 89 season and were regarded as more modern in newspaper reviews. The initial reviews for the 40 Thieves were favourable, praising the sets and costumes, and especially the Schaefer troupe of acrobats. But there are clues in the reviews that indicate that which divided the Theatre Royal pantomime from those at the Prince's and the Comedy. Reviews for the 40 Thieves refer to the use of original music, composed especially for the pantomime. While Thomas Ramsay's Sinbad the Sailor at the Prince's Theatre and Edward Garcia's Aladdin at the Comedy made much more extensive use of music hall stars, who sang their own hit songs already familiar to the audiences. The second reviews, published in January, also suggest that Garcia and Ramsay refreshed their offerings after Christmas, changing some of the music hall turns to breathe fresh life into their productions. This does not appear to have happened at the Theatre Royal, which may have been due to Bainbridge's awareness of his precarious financial situation preventing him from doing so. The pantomimes at the Prince's and the Comedy Theatre were as remarkable for their successes that year as the Theatre Royal's was for its failure. Thomas Ramsay, the manager who would become Bainbridge's replacement at the Theatre Royal, when asked in 1893 which of his pantomimes had had the longest run, recalled that it was Sinbad the Sailor at the Prince's Theatre during the last year of my management there. That would be 1888. Sinbad was played for 13 weeks. When his interviewer pointed out that in recent years managers had not striven after the magnificence in the production of pantomimes to the extent that they strove not very long ago, Ramsay agreed and continued to explain that the taste for the gorgeous has been dying for some time, and what the people of today undoubtedly want is a funny pantomime, something brisk and bright that will make them laugh. Pantomime had gradually been increasing the amount of music hall entertainment it included for several years. The 1888 to 89 season can now be seen to mark a specific moment in Manchester theatre history, when the shift in public taste from spectacle to music hall as the main feature of their pantomimes, and a slight misjudgment on the part of Bainbridge became the immediate cause of his bankruptcy. The Theatre Royal 1888 pantomime created a further disadvantage for Bainbridge. The sharper commercial acumen of Ramsay and Garcia, as in Ramsay's interviewer's comment that the theatre managers were no longer striving after the magnificent in pantomime, indicates that the Comedy Theatre and Prince's Theatre had invested less money in the production of their respective pantomimes at the same time as they were achieving higher ticket sales and were therefore able to move into profit much earlier in the run. The taste for a funny pantomime and a return to an emphasis on audience participation was something they encouraged for its commercial benefits to the theatre business, manipulating public taste for their own profit. Bainbridge's belief that, as in recent years, he could buy success was proven to have been misplaced. During his bankruptcy hearing, the newspapers referred to him admitting his theatre's dependence on pantomime, stating that he first knew he was insolvent in 1884, but he looked forward as usual to the pantomime pulling him round again. The pantomime generally helped him get straight, but the pantomime he produced last Christmas, instead of helping him meet his liabilities, resulted in a further loss of £8,000. If that pantomime had been a success, he would never have come to that court. Bainbridge remained popular in Manchester after his bankruptcy. The evidence suggests that he had a romantic view of business and limited practical skills or financial judgment. It can be seen, though, that the life of a provincial theatre manager at that time revolved around and was dictated by the annual pantomime, and that his continued survival and that of his theatre was a fragile thing, dependent on the commercial and critical success of one production each year and correctly judging its appeal to a fickle public. Thank you.
Thank you, Claire. No, I didn't have to give you 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. Okay, questions, observations? Mark?
Can I ask, am I right in thinking that debt is a colossal figure? Because I'm right in thinking in today's money it's about 12 million quid.
The problem when you try and... I have looked at various sources to try and convert... it's into what people think that might be today. And for one thing, they all come out with different answers. but I think a lot of that is to do with things have kind of got a different value. You can look at exactly what it might convert to in cash terms. But if you think about the plot of land where the Theatre Royal is in the centre of Manchester now and how much that would cost, that would be more... I think, than just converting it into terms of cash inflation. So, in fact, it'd be interesting to find out how much they've just sold it for, really. Because it has just been sold in the last few weeks. It's going to be converted into a hotel. I've heard various... I think when I looked at it on like a cash converter, it said £1.5 million. That is no way that you'd be able to go and buy that and everything that went with it for £1.5 million today. So that's perhaps quite a good estimate, 12 million something.
What I mean is, as I say, at the time was it regarded as colossal? I'm just curious how he managed to string it along for so long.
When Edward Garcia went bankrupt the following year, he owed £6,000. And the Charles Bernard one from 1882, I think, was about £4,500. So you know, you kind of compare to that. I mean, I suppose it helped that his creditors weren't, his auntie and sister and that, weren't chasing him for the money. That might have put, because in the end, when he was actually pushed into bankruptcy, somebody took him to court because he owed them £58. And it all tumbled down from there. But I mean, he was having problems by that point, that people were refusing to supply him. And at the beginning, there is quite a lot, when you read into all the court case, he says it's like malicious rumours that people had been spreading around, that he wasn't going to be able to afford to pay his bills. And so he'd just thrown everything at doing this massive, spent loads and loads of money in the hope that the pantomime would make him loads and loads of money. But he was having problems with people refusing to supply him because he wasn't paying them. So what they were saying was true, even though he said it wasn't. And of course, once the rumour mill starts getting going, and I mean, like I mentioned about the trouble he had with when he was taken sued by Augustus Harris 2 years before then, and I sort of have the impression that that's when the businesses started realising that he probably wasn't going to pay up on things. But of course, because he didn't keep proper records anyway, you know, I spent a lot of time thinking where there might possibly be any records for it. And then as soon as I started reading this, I thought, well, it's not a case of records haven't survived, it's that they never existed in the first place. So
I think you have to accept that sporting entrepreneurs or leisure entrepreneurs in this period were the original Dell boys.
Mm.
They were. They just, you know, they took losing money and going bankrupt as a matter of course.
Yeah, I think that certainly applies to people like Charles Bernard. But I think Bainbridge was a bit more of a romantic, and he'd come from this quite wealthy background as well, so he was not used to being short of money, and he just wasn't really a businessman. I think he just liked being in the theatre and married an actress. Her parent family would be quite wealthy as well, so I think in that version he's slightly different than some of the others that were buying and selling. I mean, I mentioned earlier on about, I took it out because I was a bit worried I might not have enough time, but I mentioned about the syndicate that he went into in 18, shortly after he took over the theatre. And the other partners in that syndicate were John Hollingshead, Michael Gunn, and Richard Doyley Carp. Now, they were very experienced theatre managers. And I did, when I read the details of that, because this partnership only lasted about 15 months, and I'm thinking, well, why did they get involved with him in that case? And I have asked myself, I have no idea about the answer, but I have asked myself, did they do that on purpose? Were they trying to break him and take over the business? I could be being really mean to them, and totally, they might be totally innocent, but it just seems a bit suspicious because they were all very experienced theatre managers.
Thank you very much, Claire.